Free FM.
Penn Jillette.
Hi, this is Penn Jillette on CBS Free FM, and I'm sitting here with Michael Goudeau, and we have, like all our guests, a very special guest, Peter Sagal. So, I mean, glancing at your name tag, just notice that when I said your name?
Yeah, I
just wanted to glance at sure. He's at a conference. He's got a little name tag on.
I do. I rarely get to wear these things, and I'm walking around, and
I know.
It's great because I'm getting solicited by a lot more prostitutes than I usually do.
And they go, Peter.
Yeah, they do. But, you know, I can tell they're glancing at my bosom before they say it, but that's okay.
He's on NPR. Yeah. Government radio,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've been on your show. Wait, don't tell me.
Yeah.
And is that the only show you do on there?
That is the only
That's
show
all
I
they
do.
Get out of you?
That's basically it, and it's amazing that they even get that, frankly. Because they pay me, they're lucky I show up to
and
see
how
it.
How long have you been doing that show?
This show has been on the air since January 3rd, 1998, so we are now in our ninth year, which mm-hmm. I find kind of astonishing,
wow.
frankly. Yeah.
What did you do before that?
Before that, I was this is more true than I want it to be, but I was sitting around listening to NPR all day without a gainful employment and thinking, I should do that. They should give me a show. I could pontificate for about an hour a week about nonsense. Why not?
And then you pitched it to them?
No, not at all. I need to come up with a story like yours. You know, you're on the street, you're performing, there's this guy. You say, hey, let's partner. You rise up to the ranks. No, basically, I got this phone call one day. I was a playwright and screenwriter living in New York at the time, and I got a call from a friend of mine saying, hey, I know some people at NPR. They're putting together a new radio show, and they're looking for funny people who read a lot of newspapers, and I thought of you, said friend. And I was like, oh, and as I said, that stuff about me listening to NPR and just saying, damn, this is rightfully mine, is not nonsense. So I was waiting for that call my whole life, and I called the person he told me to call, and the next thing you know, I was a panelist on this new radio show called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the birth of which I had absolutely nothing to do. I was, you know, I was just this guy who walked in based on a cold call. And now it's my life.
And
so
you took over, you killed and despoiled
I'm a little nervous now.
It's remarkable. I had no idea how savage and hierarchical the world of public radio is. But basically, you know that episode of Star Trek, Mirror, Mirror, an evil world where you can only advance through assassination? Public radio. Yeah, I had to kill him. His name is Dan Coffey.
Dan Coffey from Duck's Breath.
Dan Coffey from Duck's Breath. Yeah. He was a great guy, and I have good friends in Duck's Breath. And I was sorry about the way this happened, but it wasn't working. It wasn't happening. And so they basically they called me up one day and said, he's not working out, but we hear something host-like in your voice, he said, said the producer, and we wonder if you want to give us a try. And I had never done anything like this in my life, ever. Never been on the radio, never hosted anything, not even a party. And next thing I know, I was doing it. So there you are.
And you've been loving it?
It was weird. Somebody once sent me one of those internet quizzes, you know, what's your favorite movie, what's your favorite this, what's your favorite that, what's your ideal job?
Uh-huh.
And I talked about, and I thought about my skills. What are my skills? I know a little about a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
I can talk about anything for about 30 seconds until such time as it becomes clear that I know nothing, that I read it. I was reading an article in the bathroom, you know, and that's how
Do you read the whole article or do you read the first paragraph?
I read the first, and my mind wanders, yeah. Which is another problem. I have a very short attention span.
Dennis Miller just reads the first paragraph.
Well, you know, they teach you in journalism school, put the essential
sure.
information there. Yeah. And so
the inverted pyramid.
It's a time-saving device for the rest of us.
Yeah.
and basically, so what do I got? I got the short attention span, wide, very shallow pool of knowledge. I like to banter, and I don't like to work very hard. Mm-hmm. And what better?
And you do this out of Chicago?
We do this out of Chicago.
Because I only did your show. I only called in.
Yes, know? I know.
So I don't know. There's a live audience there, right?
There's a live audience in Chicago. We do it out of Chicago every week. In front of a live audience, and this is the
how many people in the live audience?
There's about 500 there every week.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I would think for the radio you have like 20 and try to pass it off.
Well, we do have these computerized digital things that can, Mel Gibson did with Braveheart. You just sort of triple the people with computers.
Uh-huh.
But no, we actually have 500 actual people who pay money, good money, to hear a radio show that they're going to hear for free on the weekend. But you know.
Not for free. It's our tax money, sir.
Well, you know, let
already
me...
Already paid for.
Let me disabuse you of that notion, my friend, because the fact of the matter is, as you know, public radio, national public radio, gets very little money from taxpayers.
Very little. Very little is not none.
That's very little. It's about 40 cents. Would you like yours back?
Yes, I would.
All right.
Because I get to call in, so I have no idea what it feels like to be on the set.
It's fun. We have everybody on stage. We have people like Paula Poundstone, Roy Blunt Jr.
She's on all the time.
She's on all the time because she's fabulous.
She's really good.
Your good friend, Mr. Paul Prevenza, recently joined our panel. He's a fabulous guy. Plus guys who sort of came up with us, like Adam Felber and Charlie Pierce and Roxanne Roberts. So three of those people selected in the manner of the Mission Impossible opening sequence. With myself being Phelps, are sitting there. Myself, Carl Castle, 500 people in front of us, people calling in. We had you and our other special guests call in because, frankly, we can't afford to fly people in yet.
Yeah.
And I also think there's a certain kind of weird self-loathing in that we would never ask anybody to fly to Chicago just to be on our little show. Oh, Mr. Penn Jillette's going to be on. Well, let's just make sure he doesn't have to bestir himself in any way, is sadly... our attitude, and I think we need to get a little more aggressive.
Yeah, that way. Yeah. Well, now you've been on my show. I guess I should at least fly into Chicago and do yours.
You should absolutely.
Now,
you bring foie gras with you, though, if you're going. Just bring it in your suitcase.
You know what's great? That in Chicago, as you were referencing, banned foie gras, and the restaurants have risen up in this fabulous revolt.
It's really great.
And not only are they serving foie gras, they're actually taking the ducks. It comes from ducks, not geese, it turns out. And they're slaughtering them and removing their livers in Daily Plaza every day at noon. And the blood runs in the gutters. It's sad. The Mies van der Rohe Plaza there with the little – and the blood gets in the little spaces between the – it's awful. And the mayor is powerless to stop it.
Now, they're giving it out free in some restaurants.
They're giving it out free.
Changed the name.
Yeah. So. Actually, you know, it's – in Pizzeria Uno's got the deep dish pizza. And now they have like one. It's not only a foie gras pizza; it's just foie gras. So you go in, and it's about like 12 inches across and 4 inches deep of duck liver.
Now the foie gras geese have a good life. Ducks have a good life, right?
Well, I mean, I guess if you're a duck,
I would love to just be held down and force fed to my liver swelled and popped.
That would, it's, you know, if you got to go, I guess.
I just
saw you eat. I don't think they'd manage it. They're like, my God, he's taken so much, and he asks for more, the cuisinaires would say.
No. So have you had foie gras since the ban?
We have eaten foie gras post-ban, and it's wonderful because you just have this wonderful
sense. You're in a speakeasy.
Sense. Yeah.
You knock on the door, hey, what's the password? You can't come in unless you say Swiss.
René sent me. And you go in, and then everybody eats foie gras and stands up and sings the Marseillaise. It's great. it's the perfect kind of rebellion for affluent Americans in which basically you're risking nothing and enjoying yourself in the meantime.
Absolutely,
so
absolutely.
We're having a good time with it.
And the trans fats are banned there yet, right?
We haven't yet banned the trans fats, but we're working on it. I don't know, how did, in the name of all that is holy, did Chicago, Illinois, meat packer to the world, city of big shoulders, corrupt in every way, how did we become the absolute woo-woo do-gooders of America? We're out Berkeleying Berkeley, and it's embarrassing.
And that's the weirdest thing. We played the Chicago Theater several times.
Sure.
And I have a bit where we start with me juggling torches.
Yeah, sure.
Then I juggle the torches, then I go and I juggle broken bottles. And we played this years, all around the country. And it's illegal. You're not allowed to have open flame on stage.
Oh, yeah, right.
Everywhere. So you have the fire guy come in.
Yeah.
And the fire guy says, what are you doing? And you tell him, how long you've been doing it. And you really tell him that there's a fire curtain. And although... they have to clear everything. He gives you a little certificate that says they've okayed it. Indeed, it is safe. You know, we have fire extinguishers in the wings, and there's only so far they can go. And with the physics and so on, it's very, very safe. The worst that's going to happen is a small burn on my hand, which they don't care about. And they okay the fire rating. Every city we play. And then some cities, you reach a little bit of resistance. And then you say to the firemen, you know, your kids like Penn and Teller, your family, can we get some tickets tonight? And how about a few T-shirts? Right. And then, you know, how much did your cab fare cost over here? And there are other ways to go. Very rare we get to the point of actually doing an illegal payoff to a fire person, but it's happened.
Okay.
We get to Chicago, right?
Yeah.
We've been touring this forever. Okay, no way. Everything we try. Nothing works. How can Chicago be the city where you can't bribe someone?
Well, we're still hurting over the whole Chicago fire thing.
I guess that must be it. Actually, they thought that it was an anti-Christian remark I made on the radio show.
Did it
the
really?
Day before. That's what they thought, yeah. That was what
did
the
say?
Crew finally decided. Anything. I mean,
why need I ask?
Yeah, constantly.
Like, in today's vicious slander of Christianity, here we go. I mean,
you know, it's the war on Christmas.
It's a regular feature, I guess, for pendulums. Yes, I should have known.
I was part of the war on I was part of the war on Christmas.
There is true that the Chicago Fire Department, as we all saw in the movie Backdraft, has this very odd, well, not odd, I guess, but very sort of sincere sense of their own professionalism. And it's just this part of Chicago fire culture.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why. There's like, no way are they going to let this big guy from out of town bully them.
I did the trick with torches that weren't lit and said the Chicago Fire Department presents the Theater of the Mind. Imagine now you can hear the sound of the flame and the walls are lighting up in odd shadows as it moves. And imagine the slight excitement of seeing real. I did that and went over wonderfully. It absolutely killed.
That's great.
I tried to do it because I thought, well, this might save us $500 a night in bribes. I tried doing it in another city, and somehow, without the reality of not being able to do it, I could make it funny.
In Chicago, and I've lived all over the country, and you know, usually most places when a fire truck or ambulance comes up behind you, most people calculate. They go, well, is he going to be in my lane? Is he going to turn? I don't think he's going to turn. A lot of people try to follow the fire truck. Mm-hmm. Hey, he's getting through traffic. Happened in L.A. all the time. Chicago people, when they hear a siren, they don't even see it yet, they pull over to the side of the road. They get out of their cars.
And have some foie gras.
And assume the crash position. It's amazing. There's this tremendous respect for the men in red.
And they should. They
as
should.
Well.
I mean, firemen are, you know, wearing a fireman's jacket.
Yeah, you have one, don't you?
I have
you?
A fireman's jacket.
You mean the whole sort of waterproof
with the yellow
thing.
Stripe around it and everything? I bought one. I bought one as a sex aid. And walking around in a fireman's outfit is like being a woman walking around in a Catholic schoolgirl outfit. You are tapping into fantasies like crazy. And I would wear it, like, to the airport to fly, because it's not an uncomfortable jacket.
Yeah.
And people would know I wasn't a fireman. There was no chance. They would recognize me. But I got hit on. I mean, actually hit on.
Really?
I actually had women coming up to me and going, hi, how you doing? You're Penn Arthur. And working me because of the fireman's jacket. And then I stopped it on 9/11 because I thought
that it was really bad.
But I'm thinking...
It's been five years. I believe they're...
Maybe I could wear a fireman's jacket again. But you know how you've sometimes seen women dressed remarkably slutty or in some sort of symbolic outfit like garters or cheerleader or something, and you just go, man, if I were a woman, I would dress like that all the time. That's the way I should. That's the way I would play my hand. You've said that to yourself. I know you have.
Actually, I always quote Steve Martin, which is, if I was a woman, I'd just stay at home and play with my breasts.
Absolutely, and they do.
Yes, you know they do.
Yeah, but you would do that. But I mean, you would also, if you were going out trolling, you would wear some symbolic sexual outfit.
It's so easy.
It's so easy, and yet you don't even know this until I'm telling you, I'm the Louis Pasteur of getting lit. All you got to do is get yourself a fireman's jacket and just wear it. And when they say to you, are you a fireman? You go, no, I just, you know, like the culture, and I really respect those men. And they're just going to... Because you're wearing, you know, you may not be able to take it off when you get to the sex act. I mean,
yeah.
it's really...
Because all of a sudden...
And I have a friend of mine who is very, very attractive and a good-looking guy. And as a joke, my girlfriend and I at the time bought him a fireman's jacket. And he said he could not wear it in public because he had fights with his wife.
Really?
So he was kind of wearing it as a joke.
The women were coming up.
Yeah, just like that. I think being a fire... So, yeah, I think we want to have respect for them. And there is something very important. They are the cheerleaders of men.
That's an interesting thought. I hadn't had that point. I guess I don't know enough firemen. I know some cops, and they don't report that, you know,
in terms of
it's very different.
Only because sexually with cops, people aren't able to admit it to themselves as readily.
You think there's some sort of weird, you know, I can't admit that I'm
attracted to this paramilitary figure. Yeah, but a fireman does nothing. They're saving kittens for the love of Christ.
Yeah, there's no downside to the fireman.
I don't know if that would work for me because I'm smaller than you are, and I think if I got, you know, the real fireman's coat, it would sort of drag on the floor like Bugs Bunny when he's dressed
as a gangster.
You know,
they make it for your size.
They make it for your size.
This is kind of technical.
I don't know. If you think I would look like a kid dressed as a fireman on Halloween?
No. You'd be okay.
All right, I'll try it.
Give it a try. I mean, it's a good one. It's like a $150 investment, you know?
You need the yellow stripe.
You need the yellow stripe.
Right.
And also, you're in Chicago, so it's almost justified.
Yeah.
Put a sweatshirt under it and stuff, a little bit of drizzle or rain.
Could I get a Chicago Fire Department t-shirt and just pretend I'm a mufti? You don't think that's going to work?
I don't think you should. I don't think you should pretend you're anything you're not.
Just like, wear the cup.
I mean, when you see a woman who's 25 years old wearing a Catholic schoolgirl outfit, you don't say, "I wonder if she's enrolled at the Catholic school." Do you?
Yeah, I have a bad experience of that because I tried to pick up some girls who were wearing that outfit, and they turned out to be Catholic schoolgirls.
Yes, see, that's the bad thing.
See,
that's a bad thing.
I didn't sense any irony, but I went ahead forward. And
yeah, you want them to be packing, you know, 36 double D's or something,
yeah,
so
otherwise.
You know that they're fully matured.
It's a gesture. Otherwise.
I mean, it's just symbolic. You don't want it to ever have any sort of reality. Just like, you know, maybe you've got something to offer that a real fireman wouldn't like. Okay, maybe you don't.
Yeah, I was about to say. I don't know. Maybe, I'm not saying. Maybe they don't have my skill at badinage.
I don't even know what that is.
Is that you see? Uh-huh.
See, a little bit of everything.
Is that part of, like, the fireman test where they make you climb up the building, you know, the fake building carrying, and then they make you come down and chat amiably over cocktails?
What's
I don't think so.
What was that word you use?
Badinage? Badinage is it's sort of light and pleasant conversation in a back and forth way.
I guess you would know that on your,
that's
on your show.
That's why I'm a chick magnet, because I know words like that.
Now, do you write the stuff on
I
the
write
show?
A lot of it. I don't write all of it. There's sort of two sort of controlling factors. On one end, I work with a staff, and they all contribute, and I redo what they do, and then they veto or applaud of what I've done. So it all ends up being a kind of collaborative outfit. But I do write at least the basis of most of it. And then there's the fact that we do the show, and you got a sense of this maybe when you were on it. We do the show. We have our panels, all of whom are incredibly inventive and funny and quick, and we have the people calling in, and we never know what's going to happen. So it ends up being an improv based on a script as much as anything. Mm-hmm. And then the show is edited. So a lot of times, certainly the best things that come out on our show, I think, are the things that are spontaneous. And I can give you an example if I have time for one.
Sure,
which
you do.
Is,
you're here for the whole hour.
Tom Hanks was on our show.
You flew him in.
We would have had he asked. He was on the phone as well. And Tom Hanks was on the show. Paula Poundstone, Roy Blunt Jr. was on the panel. And we were quizzing Tom, if I call him Tom, about the history of CADs in Hollywood, the theory being, you know, he's one of the nicest guys in Hollywood, registered trademark, therefore we'll ask him about people who are not so nice. One of the questions, Errol Flynn. How did Errol Flynn meet his third wife? One of the options was, turned out to be the true option, by the way, that he met her because she was running the snack bar in the courthouse where he was on trial for statutory rape. So Tom Hanks is contemplating the options, and he's sort of thinking about that one. That sounds most reasonable to him. And he says, do courthouses have snack bars? And there was a pause, and Paula Poundstone said, yes. And it was literally 5 minutes before we could get control of the room. And that, you know, in my humble opinion, I could sit and write far more seriously than I do, and I will never, ever come up with anything as good as that. So I don't know.
Delight.
Yeah, she's great. And that's actually our great advantage, because let's face it, there are so many smart people and so many good writers doing what I do. Mm-hmm. There's Jon Stewart and his staff and Stephen Colbert and Bill Maher and, you know, the Leno monologue writers and the Letterman monologue and on and on and on. And I'm just this one guy sitting in Chicago after they've all had their shot. And I think if the show entirely depended on the wit and wisdom of Peter Sagal, you know, I'd be doing a little podcast, I think, while supporting myself as an insurance salesman. But fortunately, I've got all these amazing people who are on the show with me who can be counted on to make up for my shortcomings pretty much every week.
We have Peter Sagal, and we're trying to make up for his shortcomings. Those who are trying it are Michael Goudeau, and I'm Penn Jillette. We'll be on CBS Free FM. FM, CBS Radio. This, of course, why wouldn't it be, is Penn Jillette. Sitting with Michael Goudeau, who's saying very little because we have Peter Sagal here, who's telling us about Wait, Don't Tell Me, and all his rather exciting adventures. And we talked about firemen's coats and things
fireman's
like
coats,
that.
Yeah, and I'm taking notes about ways that I need to score chicks.
I think so. But I'll tell you, I, because of doing this show and a few other things, went back to reading more newspapers. And I've asked people a lot how you get to be someone who knows all about the news, and I've gotten advice. What is your regimen for learning what's happened each day?
Well, I will say this, that I used to be much more on top of the news than when I didn't, you know, it wasn't my job, because I am a terrible procrastinator. And the reason that back, as I told you before, that my friend thought of me as someone who read a lot of newspapers was because then my job was writing. Mm-hmm. And I would so much more rather read a newspaper than write.
Well, yeah, it's like that's like Benchley's line. There's no amount of work a man can't do if it's not what he's supposed to be doing.
Exactly. Once when I was in college, I was so desperate to finally stop procrastinating and finish something that I got myself a library carol in the library that the graduate students check out. Mm-hmm. And I made sure that this graduate student was doing his or her, I have no idea, PhD in German. And all the books were in German. So therefore, I could not distract myself with anything. I swear to you, within 35 seconds, I was trying to teach myself German. I was like, that word clearly is a definite article, so this word terrifying. I know the nouns are capitalized. But to answer your question, basically, you know, you just start. I read the New York Times every day. I read the Washington Post every day. I read the LA Times every day. I read the Chicago Tribune every day, which doesn't take very long. I read, thankfully, there is a whole bunch of sort of web aggregators.
Yeah, I use Google Reader.
Google Reader is a great one. Slate, I always start with Slate, Today's Papers.
That's where I start.
There's a lot of, and then there are all these, because of the specialized nature of our show, you know, we need funny stories, we need odd stories, we rely on a lot of FARC.com and Reuters, oddly enough. And sometimes you just sort of sit there and let it flow over you. Mm-hmm. And look for nuggets. A lot of times, I mean, when you're totally immersed in it, like I am, thankfully, we do a show once a week. So a lot of times it'll take the whole week of just reading a bunch of stories to realize, oh, wait a minute, there's this weird aspect of that that we can talk about. Sometimes you don't catch it till you're sort of going through it the last time.
Well, Paula Poundstone did not know my daughter's middle name.
She didn't?
She did not.
I want to tell you, by the way, I'm here at this convention with my wife. And we saw you and your wife and your kids. And I said, look, there's Penn and his daughter, Moxie Crime Fighter Gillette.
There you go.
And my wife said, I so want to be called Crime Fighter Gillette. It really was a strange moment of insight. I've known her for so long, and I didn't know that. So now I'm calling her Crime Fighter.
Crime Fighter, I think, is a fabulous. And now, in the way the wacky world of the web works, there are now a couple of kind of semi-like Suicide Girl type sex sites where there is a Moxie Crime Fighter.
You're kidding
so
me.
So now my daughter's
Your
name...
Your daughter has become a porn name?
Absolutely.
That's terrible.
And there has popped up... I went to the adult convention here in town.
Yeah, the research. The A... Whatever
AVN.
They call
it. Yeah, AVN. And there was a porn star named Moxie, M-O-X-X-X-I-E. To the XXX.
Did you talk to her? Was it in fact an homage?
I didn't talk to her, but I asked the man who I believe they're called pimps. The man who was there selling the videos, and he said, "Oh yeah, one of the magicians has a daughter named that."
Wow. Did they recognize you? Did you walk around that convention and get called out?
I thought that when I've been doing Penn and Teller for 30 years and doing our Bulls hit show on television and all our live shows, that I had hit kind of saturation.
Sure.
Then I started doing a primetime game show called Identity on NBC. Everything changes.
It's amazing.
There's a bump up that you can't believe. So I used to go to the porn convention, and the level of recognition was beautiful.
Yeah.
Because one person at every booth would make me, and that was, you know, as often as not, one of the very attractive women.
Of course.
And then they'd want to chat with me, and it was terrific. But this year there, I've hit the tipping point, the critical mass, where for some reason, guys at the porn show would now rather get my autograph than look at really scantily clad women. And this became counterproductive to all of us.
Really?
Because then I couldn't get to the
scantily clad women.
And they were facing the wrong way. So there would be women wearing Catholic schoolgirl outfits, for example, with the tops totally open and very attractive, and the guys would be coming over and saying, Penn, would you sign this? And I would try to point out to them, look, naked woman. Like, you know, so I was very hard to move around the convention, although it's very nice. But then also, if one of the attractive women were to recognize me, she also can't. There's guys around me getting my autograph. And it's such a weird thing. And I was talking to Taylor Wayne, who you may know as a porno star.
Oh, sure.
Taylor Wayne. And she was telling me that she has been in a room with a dozen women, mostly undressed, and Ron Jeremy, and men will push through the nearly naked, gorgeous women to get to Ron Jeremy. So there's some sort of weird herd instinct that happens there. And I know you're going to say, I'm a heterosexual guy, and if I given a choice between, for instance, Tom Hanks and 12 very attractive, nearly naked women, I would go talk to the women and not to Tom
Hanks.
Actually,
I like Tom Hanks a lot.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly.
Well, there's a fame thing, and fame may be even more important than lust. Yeah, who knows?
Is that that's impossible. The human race could not have survived this long if fame was more important than lust.
Well, I was about to say, this doesn't say, well, I mean, it would hard to imagine that we would evolve in such a way, evolve brains.
Because fame is new. Recognition is new. We haven't had pictures long enough for it to have changed.
Yeah,
you wouldn't be able to recognize Caesar came up to you to go, yeah, whatever. There's naked girls up here. Out of my way, dude. You know what I mean? You wouldn't have known that.
But there, I mean, there's actually something. I've been reading a lot of evolutionary biology recently.
Good.
I know. I'm a big fan of Mr. Dawkins, who I know is a pal of yours, and just read his book. I read his old book, The Selfish Gene, and working through some of his new books. And there is actually some evolutionary theory behind our relationship to status.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That somehow our response to fame. People such as yourself, is in fact related to deep evolutionary reproductive
strategies.
Maybe
I'm just trying to come off as a big old silverback.
Yeah, exactly. It plays a role in humans. I want you to know, though, before this moment passes, that I'm interested in your experience in porn because I myself have been involved in kind of a research way with the porn world for the last year. I'm working on a book called The Big Book of Vices, and it's basically about ways in which people misbehave. And one of the things was about porn. And I made a discovery that in the world of porn stars, my demographic, people who know who Peter Sagal is, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, is exactly one, Nina Hartley.
It was a good friend of mine.
I've become friendly with her over the past year.
She's fabulous.
She's totally fabulous. In fact, I just got her book for my wife.
And she wears Catholic schoolgirl outfits.
Yeah.
She has in some of her movies.
I know.
Exactly my point. You put on a fireman's outfit next time you see Nina, you'll find everything will go even better.
You think so?
I think so.
I don't know.
I got an email from Nina today, as a matter of
fact. I think Nina's the best. I think I owe her an email because, like I said, we've been going back.
Send her a little picture of you in the fireman's
You think
outfit.
I would
Just try it. Just
Because I got to say, I mean, I read an interview with Nina. Because I'm a huge fan of her. She's so remarkable and amazing and one of a kind. And basically, one of the things she was responding to the question of, you know, do people expect you to be, you know, sexually promiscuous all the time with everybody you meet? And basically, she said was, people come and have expectations of me, certainly, but if I want to have sex with you, you will know it. She's not shy, as we now know.
Absolutely.
And so I met her, and I interviewed her in her home, and then I had dinner with her when she came through Chicago a little while later. And
did you know it?
And no, I was waiting for the signal because I was like, having read that, I wasn't going to try anything. I wasn't going to like be forward, but I was just going to wait for the moment to come. And I wore my best purple shirt and got nothing. Although she did say the single greatest thing that anyone has ever said to me.
Two words.
What? Fireman's truck. I know. Nina, give me another chance. If you're listening, Nina, it looks good. It's sort of a duster on me. No, she said the single greatest thing anybody has ever said to me in a pretty decent lifetime of talking to interesting people. We were again talking about that topic of her relationship to the public, what they expect of her, and her rules for public appearances. She was about to do one at a club in Chicago, and she basically said, you know, you can touch me anywhere except where a bikini would cover. That's my rule, you know? I mean, I know who I am, and I know what they want from me.
And the middle of the upper shoulder.
Yeah. But then she said, well, an exception, of course, is my ass. She said, I can talk about Nietzsche while a crowd of people gropes my ass.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's the greatest thing anyone's ever said to me. So I could never say that to anyone else. But, yeah, the porn world is interesting. The porn world is it's a strange place.
Yeah, it's very weird. And what I love about it, besides the obvious, is the overlaps to the carny world. The fact that you grab the outsiders, you know, and that there's a feeling that, you know, there's a Bob Dylan line, to live outside the law, you must be honest. And what attracted me to carny when I was a kid was the fact that whatever reason you were an outsider, very unpleasant reasons, like, you know, being an ex-con for one, or being an escapee or parole jumper or something, plus the other ones, like, of course, in the before gays became acceptable to be gay. I mean, people in the carny were heavily gay, or to have even political opinions or something that just left you away from your friends and neighbors, or, for instance, to be attached to your brother or sister by the head.
Yes.
The real freak
all
stuff.
Socially unacceptable.
Anything that kept you outside of that made this kind of community, which I've always romanticized tremendously.
There's a great book I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
There's a great book called Coming Attractions that Nina's husband, Ira Levine, co-wrote mm-hmm. with a terrific guy who's now dead from UCLA named Robert Stoller. And they interview Jim Holliday, Bill Mangold, mm-hmm. all these guys, and they talk about that incessantly, that they see themselves as outsiders. A lot of them rejected by their families. A lot of them wanted to reject their families, and they came out, and they see this world as this sort of place for rejects and outsiders. And in a weird way, I wonder how that ethos, which I think has provided a lot of joy to the people in it, is going to survive this constant mainstreaming of porn.
Its mainstreaming is unbelievable. And we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back and mainstream some more porn with Peter Sagal, Michael Goudeau, and my name is Penn Jillette on the Free FM CBS Radio. This is Penn Jillette, CBS Radio, Free FM. We have as our guest Peter Sagal, who I was afraid we were going to have to talk about NPR for the whole time.
No, I'm bored.
But you know lots of other stuff.
I like to think of myself.
Did you want to talk about more about the porno thing? What's the book you're doing about vices?
The book is called we were actually working on the title. I think the title, I was just negotiating with my editor today. It's called The Big Book of Vices, Very Bad Things and How to Do Them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those guys, and I think I'm not like you in this regard, who has wondered about more stuff than I've actually tried.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that the vast mass of America are probably more like me. They live their lives, to quote the word, quiet desperation. And they wonder what you crazy, Vegas-living, fire-coat-wearing guys.
I'm very odd that way because I don't do things if I consider them vices. You know, I've never had a drink of alcohol in my life, never any drug. And I do, and when I say never on drugs and alcohol, recreational drugs, I do mean it. So I have to have another word because most people would say, for what I do, that I've never gambled. But I have put a quarter in a slot machine.
Right.
And I have occasionally played poker, with my wife and friends. Whereas normally people who say they don't drink, they mean I still have wine at weddings or something.
Yes.
But I really mean I don't drink on that one. And then on the gambling is something else. And then I don't consider the sexual stuff to be a vice. So I'm in that weird position of when someone talks about a list of vices, I go, no, 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 yes, no, no, no. You know, whatever that kind of thing is.
I understand what you mean.
So, but I mean, you have like information on how to freebase in there?
No, I should say that the word vice has sadly in many ways become, smoking, drinking. Primarily drug use, and then. But no, that's not. I mean, frankly, I don't know much to say about that. Nor am I interested in saying much, adding much to the literature. I mean, let me put it this way: you sort of pick up People magazine, and there's this vast sort of description of this world where the cool people are going to these amazing parties and partying with porn stars and, mm-hmm. and swinging and wife swapping and stuff like that. And I found myself interested in this, but knowing nothing about it, and figured that if I, this relatively straightforward vanilla guy from NPR, went and sort of explored this world and brought back the report for the rest of us, this might be amusing and interesting
thing
to do.
That's a good way to sell it to yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no book.
No. I've been working on this book for 16 years.
You know, I'm working.
Works
on a
better
similar,
than a fireman's code.
I'm working on a similar book.
Yeah. Yes. Honey, it's a research project.
It's a book. We're going to be rich.
No, so I spent a couple years, and I'd leave the show, and I'd go and visit a porn set. I was on the set of, what's it called? The world's only live call-in sex show on Spice TV,
yep.
Playboy now owns, and interviewed some of them. And
but that's not a porn shoot, is it?
Well, I mean, it's people having actual sex in front of cameras.
Okay, well, that's
well,
okay.
It counts. It counts. I hung out here with some gamblers and talked to some casino execs and did stuff like that. And
did you go over to swing clubs and stuff?
I've been to a swing club and hung out there.
A swing club?
I've sadly only been to one.
Uh huh. Did you like it?
Well,
or were you there on a work study thing?
I was there on a work study thing.
You go with your wife?
I did go with my wife. Yeah. I have the most accommodating.
Wasn't there a Chicago politician that had a little trouble taking his wife to swing?
Yes.
Club?
Well, that's one of the things. That's exactly it. This is who I'm writing for.
And that's what bothered me so much is that I couldn't see anything wrong he did. He asked her to go. She said yes. They went. She didn't like it. He asked her to go again, and they didn't.
Well. Now, we're talking about this guy whose name now escapes me. He was actually going to be the Republican who ran against Barack Obama until this happened.
Yeah.
It came out in his divorce papers. Jack Ryan was his name.
Yeah.
Very, action hero. Yeah,
very action hero.
And he was married to the beauteous Jeri Ryan, famous as Seven of Nine on Star Trek, and now a teacher, on one of those shows. And that's, in fact, what happened, that they got divorced. But apparently, just to be fair to Ms. Ryan, apparently, and this, talking to my new friends in the swing club world, this is not that unusual. He kind of took her there without telling her where they were going.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, that's just stupid.
And
that's
so she says, let's go out to this club. And she says, okay. And they go there. And basically, he propositioned her to do something in front of these other people.
Yeah,
and she thought this was not fun.
Yeah. What usually happens in the swing world is that a guy begs for 2 years to go to a swing club. The husband and wife go to the swing club.
Yes.
He is, for some reason, unable to perform or performs too quickly.
Yes.
The wife has a blast.
Great time.
Then the next 2 years, she's begging him and he's saying no.
No.
That's the cliche. That's the joke you'll see.
Yes. Yeah. And I heard about that. I spent a long time talking to these people, this, you know, very, as is often the case, seemingly typical suburban couple. Who run the swing club in Chicago. And they described that problem. They described it's a very strange dynamic. It's a very strange dynamic where the men say it's all about the women. I don't think they're telling the truth. I think because, as you say, I mean, I think there are many dangers in this that are lurking. And one, of course, is the single men. They don't want any single men coming to these clubs. And you think about that, and you can understand what that's like. I went to a place in San Francisco, again, work study, called the Power Exchange, which is supposed, you know this place? This is like the only open admission heterosexual sex club in the country, you know, the just like Plato's Retreat was supposedly. And it's mainly a whole bunch of single guys wandering around looking for something that they're not going to find. So I understand why they want to keep that down. But if you think about it, if you're having a sex club, wouldn't it be lovely for the ladies, for whom this is supposedly all about, to have a nice selection of clean, attractive, talented men at their bidding? But no, they don't allow that, because sexual freedom of choice is a great thing, except, of course, when the choice is not you.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the weird thing. And I won't say, my wife and I spent an evening there. We talked to a lot of people. But here's the funny thing. If you go, I mean, part of their ethos is just come, just explore, you know, no pressure. It's not like a bar.
Yeah.
No pressure. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. And that's great. But you go there, and when it becomes clear that you are actually not going to have sex, people really lose interest in you.
Well,
rather rapidly.
But that's not pressure. You're there for a different reason, aren't you?
No, I mean, it's not pressure. Nobody says, come on,
Do
this or get out.
They're losing interest in you because it's like if you go to a softball game and everybody's going to play softball and they pick up teams and you go, oh, by the way,
I don't want to play.
We're not going to play softball. They'll stop throwing the ball at you.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. And that's, I have no complaint.
In both senses, it's the same thing.
Right. It was a little weird because it was the first time in my life where I have ever people, you know, I've lost chances because I wasn't willing to put out.
Exactly.
Not a typical experience for me. But it was weird. And, of course, so that was the funny thing.
You were teasing them.
I was teasing them. And particularly because my wife is not an unattractive woman. And I think they were like, because there is an enthusiasm for fresh meat.
Well, I'd say about your wife, and forgive me, is... Catholic schoolgirl outfit.
Yeah, she could probably do well. She had a Catholic schoolgirl outfit, and I wore the fireman's coat. They'd go nuts.
Yes, and then you would just say, but no, we're here to talk.
Exactly. And in fact, I actually was talking to somebody. They said, what are you here for? And I said, well, we're sort of doing research. And she actually laughed at me. She said, research? And I felt kind of bad.
Sure.
It's a weird scene because all these people are saying that this means nothing. In the terms of concept of their lives and particularly their marriages, they're able to come and strengthen. It's just sex. It's just recreation. One guy who runs the club, was comparing. It's like a massage. You know, you get rubbed in one part of your body, it's fine. You get rubbed in another part of your body, why is that bad? And so they're saying it's unimportant. It has no relevance, and yet they devote their lives to it.
Well, it's a hobby. I mean, if you talk to someone who was into philately, they would tell
that
you
that sounds dirty in this context.
They would tell you that they knew it was just stamp collecting. They knew they were just stamps. They knew they didn't matter. Yeah, they devote their life to it.
Yeah, I know. But
you know, the problem that they always make. I remember there was on the Mies Commission study on pornography.
Yes,
which was 900 pages and one person read, and that was me.
Right.
They have a thing in there that they say they're interviewing, and this is against porno, porno. They say, and I forgot the exact number, but I'm within 2 or 3 percentage points. They say that 73% of the people in pornography that they interviewed, the women, the actresses, 73% would not do these movies if they were not being paid.
Wow.
Now, let's go to McDonald's, shall we?
Okay, yes, let's.
And let's see if we can find that 27%.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I believe, and CBS doesn't really listen to this show.
No, thank goodness,
but,
otherwise.
But and the NPR doesn't listen to this show either, so we can say this. I would keep doing my show if I were not being paid. Right. I would keep doing the Penn & Teller show at the Rio. I would keep doing this. I would probably do Identity on NBC. I believe I'm the minority. Godot has said he would not work if he were not getting paid. How about you?
Well, it's hard to say. I love my job so much that I would probably miss it tremendously. But I have these three little children at home.
Yeah.
They like to eat. And here's the hard part. They occasionally injure themselves or come down with colds, and I need to take them to the doctor. So that's sort of – I would probably have to find some way to provide that for them.
But I mean, I don't know if that's the question.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, would I do my job?
If you were stinking rich.
If I was stinking rich, if there was no financial thing. I think I would. As I said earlier, I have a perfect job for me.
You're in that 23%, but yeah. I bet you know people. I bet you know people in your own personal life that if you ask them, if we gave you all the money in the world, would you keep working, might say no.
I think most people live lives of quiet desperation.
Exactly. That was your whole thing. So that's what I would say about any of that stuff. It's funny how any time someone is making a moral argument about pornography or sex, I always just change it right away to McDonald's instantly. You know, when they say a lot of the people that are working in the porno industry are insecure, they're unhappy, I go, stand-up comedians, like someone working the fryer later at McDonald's. You know, they're not really finding cause and effect.
Oh, absolutely.
They're just looking in a different way.
You may remember, since you're an authority, when the porn star, I forget her name, but it was in the early 80s, and she killed herself. Mm-hmm. And there was actually a PBS Frontline documentary on her. And it was a very typical sad story, which, I mean, legitimately sad. She was a girl, was neglected by her parents. She went to L.A. She found a lot of attention. She got into it. She got in over her head, got into drugs, despair, suicide. Terrible, sad. It was one story.
Yeah.
There are thousands of women in porn who don't shoot themselves.
Right.
And there are lots of people in other industries
and
who do.
And there is the occasional prostitute who really is putting herself through law school and really is going to get out of it. Very, very, very rare.
Yeah.
For the most part, they're just people working.
Exactly.
Know?
They're just
and
people
that's
doing
why,
what they can
what,
do.
What are the vices? You're covering swing clubs, wife swapping.
Swim clubs, gambling.
So that's a lot of Vinnie Lopez records in the rec rooms.
Oh, yeah. They have pool. They have whipped cream. we have porn. We have gambling. We have swing clubs. We have eating. What else? I need to be finishing the book soon. We have lying and acquisitions of things. And I know I'm forgetting one thing, but I can't remember what it is. So, it's basically, how this is done by these people you read about, how they go about doing it.
And are you doing any real gambling?
I've done some. There's that great line from Michael Jordan. He liked to gamble on golf, and people would say, I'm gambling Michael Jordan. He's a multi-millionaire. How much should we gamble? And he'd say, well, Michael, how much would you bet in the hole? And he'd say, whatever's interesting to you. Mm-hmm. It turns out that it doesn't take a lot of money, given my background, to be interesting to me. So, I put the Benji on the table, and my hand's already shaking.
Yeah, I get crazy. You know, I just, when I'm, putting that amount of money, a quarter, going into a slot machine.
Yeah.
Bothers me.
I know.
It just troubles me. And playing poker, when I try to play with friends at home, and I know some professional poker players, there isn't an amount of money that we could agree on that was interesting for everyone.
Yeah, of course not.
They're very comfortable throwing down $100,000 on the table. And then we have friends of mine who are jazz musicians that, $5 would make a difference. So it has to be interesting for both sides.
Well, how do you manage that?
Just to play for nothing.
Really?
That's the only way I can do it,
yeah.
And then I enjoy it much more, and I know it's not the real thing. But then again, I don't have that kind of – I don't have a lot of things in the world that I kind of want to do, but I'm afraid of doing. I either kind of do them or I don't.
Yeah, and I envy you that, because basically this part of this book was to go out and explore these things that I may never do, but I wanted to find out more about them.
Well, it'll probably be a great book. And Stop, Don't Tell Me. Wait, Don't Tell Me. Stop is the book.
Yes, exactly.
Wait, is the radio show. Peter Sagal has been our guest, sitting here with Michael Godot, and my name is Penn Jillette, and we are on the Free FM. Am I too short?
No.
This is Penn Jillette.
Check Penn Jillette weekdays on Free FM.